So first question this morning. Why do we walk barefoot during walking meditation? Okay. Well, walking walking barefoot's not absolutely compulsory. It's not an essential part of the practice of walking meditation. But at the same time, there is a different feeling when your feet are contacting the earth, and that very natural feeling. I think is something I really enjoy and appreciate. I mean, particularly if you're spending your life in the city where most of the time you're wearing shoes, and having that time with just feeling the earth underneath your feet, just connecting with the earth we live on, I think is quite a beautiful experience. So this, if we're contemplating or using the sensations and the sole of the feet as a meditation object, then there's a lot more data, there's a lot more experience there when you take your shoes off. But if for some reason you have some illness, you have a cut on your foot, or for one reason or another it's not possible to walk bare feet, or you're walking in a city or somewhere where it's not clean, then it's okay to wear shoes also. Yeah. How to decrease negative self-talk. The self-talk is an acquired habit. I mean, you're not born with it. You learn it. The more you do it, the more natural it comes to seem. And the most successful therapy for dealing with chronic depression these days is what's called MBCT, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And the theory of this school of therapy is that people who are chronically depressed have certain kind of scripts in their mind, certain kind of phrases, or what's here referred to as negative self-talk. And these become so habitual in the mind that every time you have some setback or some difficulty, then this phrase or this thought pops up in the mind, and you identify it and you believe in it, and that increases the sense of depression. So, for instance, maybe I'm hopeless. I never achieve anything. Everything always in my life always goes wrong, or something like this. So this huge general kind of statement. And so when you're primed by that kind of self-talk, then when you the slightest kind of obstacle you have, difficulty, problem, then you, oh, here we go again. See, I'm always like this. So the cognitive therapists teach people to try to recognize these negative phrases they have in their mind and to let go of them. But originally they had no kind of method for letting go. And then they were exposed to Buddhist teachings of mindfulness and combined the two. So this is one of the ways in which like Buddhist culture Buddhist approach sort of entered mainstream of Western culture these days. It's not like Buddhism necessarily being spread as a religion, but it's Buddhist wisdom which is entering into the culture of the Western world more and more. So with mindfulness, you're learning how to slow down and to be in the present moment and to recognize a thought as a thought. Now, that's a very simple phrase, isn't it? But it's quite a profound thing to see a thought as a thought, to see an emotion as an emotion, a memory as a memory. It's just that. It's just a thought. It's just an emotion. It's just a memory, no more, no less. It's just that. So one of the similes is like the mind's like a sky, the sky, and thoughts and emotions like clouds. And it's quite clear, you know, that the sky is not a cloud, the sky is not a bird, the sky is not an aeroplane. These are just things that pass through the mind. And just recognizing that simple truth as experientially, not as an idea and as a like Buddhist philosophy, but experiencing it for yourself, and anyone can experience this, then your attitude to what goes on in your mind changes. You have a new perspective on things. And this is how this kind of negative self-talk can be recognized for what it is. It's just a thought. It's just a phrase, just a habit that through negligence, and we learn how to bathe ourselves, keep ourselves physically clean from when we're baby, when we're small children. We have a shower every day, we bathe, we wash our face, we wash our hands. But the most elemental, basic kind of mental hygiene just goes right by most people. So you grow up and then suddenly you find, you know, you don't know how to look after your mind, and suddenly some bad things happen in your mind and people just drop into this kind of depressed state and don't know how to get out of it. But a lot of the basic work is done in this meditation practice, mindfulness practice, of being aware of what's going on in your mind. And not identifying with it, not saying this is who I am. So that's a basic practice. How to practice letting go. How to release from attachment. When I was a young monk, one of the Western monks asked my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he said, oh, this letting go, you're always talking about letting go, but it's so difficult. So how do we do it? And Lumpo Cha said, before you can let go, if you can't let go yet, you have to oton, you have to be patient, you just have to hold something. Just hold something like this. So like the thing with pain, excuse me, like physical pain and mental pain, if you imagine it's like, if you can imagine this is like charcoal or something very, very hot, okay, and it's on your hand like that. So the heat and the pain is restricted to the parts of the charcoal which is directly in contact with the skin, okay? But what we do normally is we feel that pain and we go like that. And that's the natural reaction to pain. You tense up, you go like that. So what happens, exact opposite of what you want to happen, instead of the pain being reduced, you increase the pain because the area in contact with the hot object has been increased like this. So what patience means, what kwam ot ton means, is it's less like that. Okay, it's still there, still hurts right in the at the point of contact. But you're not adding to it through that foolish reaction to it. You're just holding it there. And this is life skill, being able to hold unpleasant things without reacting to them. You know, some unpleasant things, you want to get rid of them. You know, you're dangerous and there's no, and you have the possibility, the ability to get rid of things, that's all right too. But sometimes you can't. It's just beyond, you just have to put up with things. And you put up with things, we're just holding them like that. If you're just like this, it's, why is it like this? I don't want it to be like this. Why always me? And it's always, and it's not fair. And you know, this is like when you hold on to something. Yeah, but it's, this is, yeah, it's like this. This is the way it is right now in my life. It's like this. It's okay. It'll change, but I can live with this. Yeah. So that's patience. So letting go, you know, is supported by patience. But letting go, we refer specifically to this idea of me and mine. Now, this is the root of all our suffering in life. Taking things which are impersonal to be personal, taking things personally, and identifying with the body and with feelings and emotions and thoughts, saying, this is me, this is who I am. So to be able to deal with that, you have to be able to see very clearly that things are not you, not yours. And again, it's an idea, it's a philosophy. It's kind of cool and profound, but that doesn't help you in real life. It helps you have to see it for yourself. But we can start off by asking ourselves these questions. Say, okay, this body, you know, this is my body, okay? Yes or no, is it my body? And so we say, what does it mean to say that something belongs to you? Yeah, what are the criteria for ownership? Okay. So if we say this, this is mine, okay, well, why would I say that? Let's say someone's given it to me or I bought it, okay, and that means that now I have power over it. So if I want to throw it in the garbage, I can. If I want to put it in my bag, I can. If I want to give it to a friend, I don't want to put it on my head, I can do whatever I want to do it because it's mine. So what it means when we say it's mine is that I have power over it, okay? So ownership is related to power. Having power over something means you have ownership over it. So the question is, what kind of power do you have over your body? Okay, so we say, yeah, this is my body, you know, keep away, this is my body. But so the first question is, can you tell your body not to get sick? Can you tell your body not to get old? Can you tell your body not to die? No, I mean, the most important things, you can't, you have no power at all. And you have so little power over your body. You know, you can do certain things to the body. You know, the body gets sick, you can take medicines, you can make it better, you can beautify the body. These days you can have injections and operations and all kinds of things to look beautiful and attractive. But really it's very, very limited what you can only do. You have a small window of opportunity, basically, that nature gives you. But you can't do anything which is outside of the boundaries which nature gives you. So when you see that, this body is just part of nature. I've been talking about this. There's solidity and fluidity and temperature and motion, and what we call the four elements. These are the constituents of the human body. But the human body, it just goes its own way according to the nature of things. But it reacts according to causes and conditions. So if you go outside in the hot sun, whether or not you want to, you'll sweat. If you go out in the very cold, you'll shiver. You know, you don't want to sweat, you don't want to shiver, but that's just what happens with the body. So the temperatures in the world range from minus 30, minus 40 Celsius in midwinter in Canada or Russia or somewhere like that to high 40s, even as high as 50 degrees sometimes in India or Africa. So you have that, this is a range of temperatures in the world from, say, minus 40 to plus 45, 50. And within that spectrum, just what a narrow band the human body can be comfortable in. You know, from, you know, if you say without clothes, well, maybe from, say, 20 degrees up to 30 degrees, maybe, you can be reasonably comfortable. So like just a 10-degree band in that whole range of temperatures. So the body is so sensitive to all kinds of external influences over which we, supposedly, the owner of the body, have no say at all. What we can do is if you're going to go to a hot place, then you can wear a hat, or you can wear cool clothing, or you go to a cold place, you can wear warm clothing. So you can do a certain amount, but only so much. So this is, we're going to let go of the physical body. It doesn't mean you don't wash anymore, or you don't take care of your body, you don't take medicines when you get sick. But what it means is you don't, this is not who you are. It's just, you know, it's just nature that you're dependent upon for a certain number of years. This is the idea of letting go. It means seeing, letting go of attachments. And we can let go of attachments because attachments are always based on faulty thinking, faulty perception. And we haven't looked closely enough. So this is the Buddhist answer. You know, it's not saying you have to believe in anything to be a Buddhist, but saying look again at your basic beliefs and ask yourself, is it really true? So it's this questioning attitude. You're really interested. What is this body? What is this mind? What is going on here? What does it mean to be a human being? These are the questions at the heart of Buddhist religion. There is one other associated meaning of letting go. And the simile, famous simile given by my teacher also, is of planting a tree. So when you plant a tree, you choose a place where you think the tree is suited. You dig a hole, you plant the tree, and then afterwards you put some fertilizer on the tree, maybe you water it, you protect it from bugs and so on. So you do all those things. That's your responsibility, let's say. But as regards the tree itself, whether it grows fast or grows slowly, whether the fruit of the tree is sweet or it's bitter, those things are outside your control. Those are natural phenomena. And so the wise person takes responsibility for those things which he can or she can be responsible for and lets go of everything else. Or to put it another way, your effort is on the creating the causes for success in whatever endeavor you're involved in. But you let go of expectation of results. And why do you do that? Because you have no control, no ultimate control over the results of your efforts. So let's say you work very hard. You put a lot of effort and you can be proud of the effort you put in. You're satisfied, done the best you can. But whether that will have a good result can depend on all kinds of things. Let's say you're in a corrupt organization and you have enemies, or you have people who use money or influence to push their program and to suppress yours, for instance. Or perhaps you put a lot of your investment into a company and then maybe you're sourcing raw materials from abroad, and then suddenly there's a earthquake in the country that's where you get your raw materials for, or a civil war, or some kind of disruption, or there's some other kind of economic problem in another country, but it spreads. And so you may have done wonderful work, really good work, But because of economic macro conditions in the world at large, or perhaps conditions around you in your society or in your company, all kinds of things can occur which you cannot prevent. So you can't say, because I did this and it's so good and it's so, therefore, it must, it should have a good result. Because there are so many causes and conditions that can come into play over which we cannot predict and which we have no control. So we can say, well, all things being well, you know, as long as there are no adverse conditions arising in the meantime, I'd be confident that this will work out well. But you always have to take into account all the things that you cannot control that could or might happen. So that's a way of letting go of the results of your action and putting your emphasis on the action itself. And that sense of, well, I did my best. I did as best as I could, given the circumstances. That's your fallback. That's your refuge. If I cannot sit without moving for all 30 minutes of meditation, is that a problem? How can I deal with the discomfort? Well, I did speak about this this morning during the meditation. And if you've never sat for more than 5 or 10 minutes at a time, 30 minutes is a long time, and I appreciate that. Nevertheless, you should try to set goals for yourself. And you say, okay, maybe I don't make 30 minutes, but I'll make 10 minutes without moving. And then if I can't, then maybe make one movement, or maybe I'll make two or three movements within 30 minutes. But this idea of trying to increase the length of time, but it's so much a function of your mind, and I was talking about the resistance and the irritation and the frustration. All these mental states increase physical restlessness. So if you're only working like willpower, I'm not going to move, you know, you probably explode. So it's not just a matter of willpower, but it's a matter of putting your mind into the mindfulness and being in the present moment and not identifying, go back to this idea of identifying with those feelings of, oh, I don't want this, you know, it's not comfortable, I don't like this. You know, these are your, it's like you're a slave and these are your masters, you know, all your life, you know. No, I don't want to, I don't like it, you know, I'm not going to do it. We develop this voice when we're about 2 years old and it's still inside your head, this two-year-old, no, my, you know, 2-year-old kid is my. And we have this 2-year-old kid in our heads. And unless you do about something about it, it'll influence you throughout your life. You get older, you don't like to admit it even to yourself. But often, you know, if you're really honest, you know, why did you do that? Well, I just didn't like it. No, my. So being patient with that. Being patient with discomfort. And say, if there's anything that will stand you in good stead in whatever you do in your life, in whatever career you have, in relationships, in marriage, become parents, whatever you're doing, that ability to be patient with discomfort is one of the most important things you could ever learn. Just to be there and just not to feel so great, you know, but yeah, I'm still here, I'm still hanging in. And not getting caught up in this, in the negativity that will arise in your mind because of the discomfort. So this is the thing, you can take these two things apart. There's the discomfort and there's the negativity about the discomfort. And this is the discovery through meditation. They're not the same thing. You can separate them. So there's a formula. There's a teacher, an American teacher, came up with this really good formula. So he said pain multiplied by resistance to pain equals suffering. And it's really useful thing to remember. So if you have, let's say you have really a lot of pain and a lot of resistance to the pain, then it's like you're in hell realm. You know, that's absolutely awful. But if you have a big pain, but you have a small resistance to the pain, or you're able to be at peace with the pain, so you have, when you multiply that big pain by the small resistance, it's not so much suffering. But if you have a small pain, but you have a big resistance, when they're multiplied together, you have big suffering. You have small pain, no resistance, very little suffering. But then if you have no resistance at all, it's like a zero. And whatever you multiply by zero is zero. So if you, no matter how much pain you have, if it's multiplied by zero, there's no resistance, there's no suffering. There's pain, but no suffering. And this is why we can see this in our great teachers like Ajahn Chah and such great monks who in their lives are sometimes in great physical pain, but they had no suffering. The Buddha himself is an example. So this is what we're trying to develop. So as with any kind of exercise, you're doing sport or yoga or whatever, you know, you don't just go for it straight away. You just gradually increase, incrementally, until you've got it down. But if your mind becomes calm and bright and peaceful, you can look at the clock and you, what? No, I can't have been sitting for that long. So where did the time go? Yeah, because your body, when you've been very mindful, your body relaxes. And if you're mindful, it doesn't mean you go to sleep. You know, it's not you, oh, it's, your time's gone so quickly because you've been asleep, but because you've been awake, then your perception of time changes very much. And you can find you sit for a long time. My mother, okay, I'm to paraphrase here. My mother is always angry. Not quite sure what the first sentence, but basically that's the gist of it. My mum's always angry. She can't put her heart to calm. How to tell her, don't be angry and calm down. So number one piece of advice, don't say to your mum, don't be angry, calm down. Because that'll make her more angry and less calm. So I worry about her future and the end of her life. I want to help her. Yeah. Well, usually people who are angry a lot are unhappy. That's why people are angry, frustration and anger. And especially if you in your job or out in the world, you know, where you have a lot of anger and you don't know how to deal with it. You've never learned how to meditate, then you just hold it in. So when do you stop holding it in? When you get home. Yeah, so people just using their family members as like tangkaya. He's the people around you like tangkaya, just to get rid of all this garbage, let off steam. First of all, it's a certain amount of sympathy and try to understand your mother. You know, what is she very unhappy about something? Is there something that can be done about that? But also, the it's not, as they say, a good idea to say, "Mom, you're always angry," and calm down, because that makes it worse. But you can talk about the impact it has upon you. And I was talking about this yesterday, to be very specific. And you say, "Mom, when you shouted at me yesterday, you know, it just made me feel so upset." And to give people feedback about the consequences of their actions in a very kindly way, not to score points or to prove that you're better than she is or something, but just to let someone recognize that when they behave in that way, that it has consequences on the people around and the atmosphere in the home. So usually as the son or daughter, particularly in society here, it's very difficult to speak to parents about their problems. But usually needs to be somebody else, and to invite your mum to go on a meditation retreat, maybe, or to go and maybe go Tio Dang Jam Wat and just spend some quiet time together and relax together, and then maybe, as it say, if you can encourage your mother to practice meditation, and that would be probably the best thing. But you'd have to be a good example, if you to show your mother that you've done this and you really see some benefit, and it'd be wonderful if your mum could experience this a bit herself. So this is the kind of things to do if there's a third person. If your mum is really not interested in Dhamma, in Buddhism, and she really a lot of resistance to, and sometimes maybe it's need to see a therapist. Maybe there's some other problem in the family between your mother, your father. It could be all kinds of things going on. I don't know. So as a child, there's only so much that you can do. And depending also on your relationship with your mother, how open your relationship is, how easy it is for you to talk about things, personal things. So some mother-child relations are very, very close, others are not, when just things you don't talk about in certain families. So be aware of what you can say and what other members of the family, particularly elder members of the family or your grandparents, for instance, can say something or not, or if your mother has faith in a particular monastery or monk or someone who can give some advice. So these are just a few of the options. How can I adjust myself in another country? So I think adapt is probably a better word there, but adapt. it's really important that you have some, just really thinking through your values and your life goals before you go into another country. Particularly as a Buddhist, you're a Buddhist. What are your Buddhist values, and what are the things that are important to you that you want to uphold? So, when you go to another country, if you feel very insecure, maybe you're going and you already have friends there and people that you feel comfortable with. But if you're going to college or university and you don't know anybody there, you're going to feel kind of insecure. And then the danger is that you overcompensate and you just want to be liked and you want to be popular, you want to be accepted. And so you'll do anything to be accepted. And then you lose sight of your principles and your values merely out of fear of being left out or not being part of things. So I think it is important to clarify to yourself what your values are before you go, and have certain boundaries for yourself. The need to and desire to make friends and to be accepted, that's natural and normal. But have a sense of boundaries and, you know, what, how far and in what sense are you willing to adapt. So example from the monks, you know, when we established our first branch monastery in England, then there were so many views and opinions about how tradition based in forests in northeast Thailand would adapt to living in England, in a cold country, and living in houses rather than kutis and so on. At least to begin with. And the most influential lay Buddhist in England at that time, a man called Christmas Humphreys. He was born on Christmas Day. He was called Christmas. And he was a high court judge, a very powerful man, and wrote books about Buddhism. And so he was of the opinion that monks would have to adapt, and they couldn't dress like this. They would have to, you know, make a new kind of uniform to fit with the West. And he had all these different ideas about what would need to be changed. So Ajahn Sumedho, who was the abbot, he conferred with Lumpo Cha. And Lumpo Cha said, "We just go there and try and live just exactly the same way as we do in Thailand. And then if there's something comes up which you really can't change, you really can't deal with, then we'll consider make some changes." And we found that could live the way that monks have lived for 2,500 years in the forest in North, in almost every, in every way. The only adaptations made were clothing. So they adapted a long sleeve angsa to cover the arms, to keep you warm in the cold, but also you can wear sweater underneath and it doesn't look it looks okay, you can't see it. But because before that, the Thai monks who were going to England, they keep this very strict, you know, they don't cover their shoulder. And then the heating costs in their monasteries, like thousands and thousands of dollars a year, a huge amount of money being spent just so that monks in the house can be in a very warm temperature and expose their arms. And also there are cultural things, like in Thailand, everyone's used, this is the way that a monk dresses, you know, he has his shoulder and his right arm exposed. But in the West, it's like these monks, you know, they're supposed to be like rip-roaring, and they're like half naked, you know, they got half, and their arms hanging out of their robes, you know, and people think it doesn't look very beautiful, not very appropriate. So it's a reason that they start to wear these. So like there's a good reason for it. And then walking on arms round, or walking on Bindabat in the cold, it's very cold temperature in the winter, then monks wear shoes on arms round rather than go barefoot. So these are kind of minor things of clothing. But most of the really important, almost all of the important things could keep just the same. So, you know, as I say, when you go somewhere strange, you know, and you think, oh, I've got, this is kind of misadwork, you know, this is inconvenient, and this, no, and this is that, I need to change, I need to adapt. But if you just look and see, yeah, usually you can go on pretty much as normal. So it's a matter of being observant of what's going on around you. And not just, this is the way I do things and everyone else just have to deal with it. So being tactful and thoughtful and considerate, gringjai, and adapting in all those ways that seem appropriate when looked at with a clear mind. But you don't have to adapt to everything. If you go to America, for instance, in certain, you know, particularly in central part, not so much in the east-west coast, but in like middle America, then you're often going to be meeting young, like evangelical Christians who want to convert you to Christianity or to Mormonism or something. So you know, obviously, I don't recommend you adapt in that way. So you're being very tactful, but being very clear yourself why, you know, you're not looking down on other religions. You respect every religion, but you prefer, for you, Buddhism's a religion. You should be able to explain why it is that you're happy to be a Buddhist, what it is about Buddhism, which you look up to and which gives you faith and helps you in your life. There seems to be little progress during my formal practice. Over the years, mindfulness does not seem to have developed much. Next to that, there is a lot of tension. Sometimes I end up getting out of meditation tighter than I got in. It seems like tanha is just too strong, and I always just end up resisting and craving. How do I deal with this? Saying that there's a lot of tension and you're tighter coming out than when you go in, then, yeah, these are obvious indications of like a gaining attitude. You want to get something from what you're doing. Want to become something or to get something, and that's how you get tense. And the more tense you get, then the less mindful you are. Less mindful you are, the more frustrated you are. The more frustrated you are, the more you push, and the more you push, the more, and it just goes on a big cycle. So I've been talking about the importance of balance between effort and relaxation. And the another simile is like you have a small bird in your hand, and if you hold that bird too tightly, then you'll hurt the bird, or it may even die. But if you hold too loosely, then the bird will fly away. So how can you just hold that bird? It doesn't, don't hurt the bird, and it doesn't fly away. And that's the kind of effort you want. So when you, I never use the word concentrate, you know, and I never say concentrate on your breath. I think it's a really misleading word. And in Thai, you know, we also have this like peng, you know. So when you peng something or you concentrate, it's like you stare at it. You know, if you stare at anything, you know, your eyes get sore. And if you stare with your mind at a meditation object, same thing, your mind gets stiff and sore. So you need a lot more, be aware of this gaining idea. You need to put more effort into the practice when you're not in formal meditation and to be maintaining the awareness. I would suggest to do some more loving kindness meditation towards yourself and others. If you have the opportunity to go on a longer meditation retreat, a 10-day course, 7-day course, or even to go and stay in a monastery for a week or 2 weeks, where you're just away from all your usual conditions and memories and perceptions, and really give yourself to the formal practice without any other concerns for considerable length of time, so that you can see some progress in your practice and get some new energy and inspiration from it. Why do you want to be a monk? Maybe it should be, why did you want to? I am a monk. As I don't have to want to be a monk because I'm one already. Well, I mentioned before, like I grew up. As a child, I had asthma, so I missed school a lot, and that was a really good thing for me, because like young boys in English schools don't do much study, you know, just sort of play around and be naughty most of the time. So I spent a lot of time at home alone. And I read a lot, so I was a great reader from when I was small. And so I may be more kind of thoughtful and introspective than most children of my age. So when I found Christianity completely unbelievable. I just couldn't. It just made no sense to me at all. It just seemed ridiculous, to be frank. So I rejected Christianity, and I followed other paths of study and interest. But the question that really crystallized in my mind in my teens, from the age of about 14 or so, is, what's the best way to live your life as a human being? What's a good life, or what's the best life? And I realized that that's quite a, that question leads to other questions. It's like, is that even a good question? You know, it doesn't mean just because you can make a question, it's worth answering, or it has an answer. So, you know, is it possible to say one life is better than another life? Or is everyone's life just different? You know? And if so, what are your criteria? You know, say, like, say you're comparing cars. Oh, you have certain points of comparison. How fast does it go? How comfortable is it? How safe is it? What's the mileage? You know, all these different things that we use as criteria to decide, you know, whether one vehicle is better than another. So I say, well, can you do that with a life? Can you say, this is a better life than that one? This person's led a good life and this person's led not such a good life. How do you make that choice, that decision? So this is what led me into study of philosophy and psychology and all these other paths, until eventually I came across the teachings of the Buddha, and it just made immediate sense to me. Just like, there's nothing I could criticize. There's nothing I could say, well, no, that it just seems so obviously true. But the to summarize the my answer, the answers I came to was that the best life is one in the search for wisdom and development of wisdom and compassion and freedom from suffering and defilement, and sharing that knowledge and understanding of how to free oneself of suffering and defilement and develop wisdom and compassion with other people. So that was my conclusion, but I didn't quite know how in practical detail to live that kind of life. So I left England and I went to India and traveled around in Asia for 2 years almost before I got back to England. And by then I was clear, I'm not going to go to university. I can't live in a normal kind of life. And I enrolled in a meditation retreat, and the teacher, as English Vipassana teacher, and he had been a monk in Thailand for a number of years before disrobing and establishing this meditation center in England. And so when he gave his talks in the evening, he would often talk about his life as a monk in Thailand. And when I heard him talk, I thought, wow, that life of a monk, that's exactly what I've been looking for the past 2 or 3 years. I never realized. And the fact that an English man could go to Thailand and become a monk for an unlimited period, this was, I was just so happy because, before that, most people that I knew, you could go to a monastery or you could go to a meditation retreat center for a month or 2 months, and then you had to leave and get a job and make some money, and then you could go back to the monastery again. But I wanted something that was sustainable, and I'd like a whole life rather than just something you can do whenever I have enough money to take a break. And so that was my initial inspiration, that this was the life of a monk, is the life which is designed in such a way as to be the optimum conditions for abandoning suffering and the freeing oneself from suffering and abandoning its cause, developing wisdom and compassion, and sharing the knowledge that one gains in that with other people. So this is exactly, it's for people like me, I thought, that the Buddha set up this institution. So it's, it's a perfect fit for me. So that was my intention. I said, so I came to Thailand, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't want to have any kind of way of getting home again, as if it was too tough. So I, made this vow to stay 5 years. But the moment I arrived in the monastery, the first day, I knew there's no way I was going to leave. This is exactly what I was looking for. And I never changed my mind ever since. So I'm very happy I made that choice. My friend said they do not need to meditate because they get samadhi from running, painting, etc. Is that true? Well, all I can say is your friends don't know what samadhi is. So maybe they think it's true, but what do they mean by samadhi? It means they're running or they're painting and they're not thinking about other things. Okay, so they're not thinking about the past, they're not thinking about the future, they're totally in the moment with their running and their painting. But that kind of activity is very superficial, and it has no lasting transformative effect on the mind. So if you read the biographies of great painters, a lot of them not very nice people at all. Picasso and people, great masters and people are just totally with their art, but they come out of that session and then they're back to their normal self. They can be cruel and nasty and unkind and abusive, come out and again get drunk and behave in the most incredible. There's no knock-on effect. It doesn't affect the rest of their life. It's just this gift they have for just kind of entering the zone in one particular area of their life. But samadhi always has a moral and an ethical component, and it is something which affects every area of our life. Our values change. Our attitudes change, our conduct changes, everything comes onto a higher level. It's an evolution as a human being with this practice, not just of samadhi, but of sila, samadhi, panya, as the engine that drives that transformation. But this ability to just to be present to something, it's very uplifting, it's exhilarating, it's a wonderful thing to feel, no question about that. But it's not a spiritual state in the sense of something that's leading to a uplifting or awakening or an evolution of the human being. Okay. How to deal with a long distance relationship? FaceTime. Yeah. Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what the statistics are, but unless you have like a set, it's for a certain period of time. Like you're a couple, and then one of you's got to go off to abroad for a year or two. It's very clear after that year or two you come back, so it's a certain set period of time, and then you make sure that you're in constant contact, and then maybe you're visiting each other, and you have to put a lot of effort into it for sure. But if it's kind of open-ended, one of you lives in Bangkok, the other one lives in Boston or something like that, then and there's no kind of time limit on it, and there's no, then I think it's very, very difficult. In the end, I guess the thing is, it's just how important the relationship is to you, and to what extent you want to prioritize that and to make sacrifices in other areas of your life for that. It's in a sense effort. You need to put a lot of effort into it, and just make it as good as you can make it. But to be frank, I think the open-ended long-distance relationships rarely work out that well. But it's not to say it never works out well, but it's tough. Why do you believe in Buddhism? Can we prove that Nirvana is real? I've been talking a lot about Buddhism as being a little bit different kind of religion, a different kind of species or category of religion to Christianity, Islam, this is the belief system, what we call the monotheistic religions. And it's not one which is so much founded upon faith and belief. But the Buddha gives us certain kind of hypotheses to put to the test. So Buddha's saying, like, if you attach, you have a lot of attachment in your mind, you have a lot of suffering. If you have a little attachment, you have little suffering. No attachment, no suffering. So you sort of look at your life and look at other people. Does that seem, that seems reasonable? And you try to reduce the attachments in your life and see what effect it has. And you start to practice those teachings of the Buddha which are immediately accessible, sort of basic, simple teachings. And you see what happens. And then as you see some changes and some development and you study more, then your confidence in the teaching becomes stronger. And that confidence is becoming stronger is because of all the teachings, those that you can put to the test have all proved correct. None of them's let you down. They've all been, yes, that's right. So that sense of you're on the path of verifying the truth of the Buddha's teachings, and so far so good. That's the kind of confidence that you have. I've been practicing for Buddhism for over 40 years, and as a monk, it's from first thing in the morning to last thing at night, and I have quite a developed critical faculty. I can look and see faults in things quite easily. But I've never been able to find fault with the teachings of the Buddha, even once in all these years. So I have very strong confidence in Buddhist teachings. As regards, can you prove that nirvana is real, then, well, you know, what does proof consist of? We say it's paccatang. It's something that has to be realized for oneself. But we can see, through the practice of inference, as I say, we can see if we, from the point I made just now, that if one way of talking about nirvana is complete absence of attachment, that's nirvana. So if you started off as a Buddhist with a lot of attachment, and now you have a few less attachments, and you can see an improvement in the quality of your life, then you can infer from that, if you carry on, then ultimately that state of complete absence of attachments exists. And but it's that's all it can be. There's like a confidence, a reasoned confidence, a certain amount of faith, but it's not proof. But you know, we often talk about how to prove something. But you know, the question is, let's say I've proved that such and such a thing is true. So then I might counter and say, how can you prove that your proof is legitimate, that the criteria for deciding on something are legitimate? You see, it's this infinite regress. You know, you have to prove that your proof is true, or prove that your proof of your proof is true. And so what is your proof? And so, okay, so now in the same schools, there's this incredible amount of testing, and the idea is that proves the, you know, educational attainments of the children. But many critics, including myself, say, no, and tests, you know, tests are not an ultimate proof of educational attainment. It's just proof of how good you are at doing tests, So we always have to go beyond the sense of proof and look at the grounds on which we decide that something is a proof or not. Anyway, that's a little bit more complex. But the question is, no, you can't prove to anyone, unless you're an arahant, you can't even prove to yourself. But you have a reasoned confidence. Previously, you mentioned that we put up with pain, uncomfortable feelings while sitting and meditating, because in real life, when we face with the illness, then we'll be able to cope. But muscle pain while meditating is also unable to put up. Now, what I, the point I was making was that what we call pain is a complex phenomena. It's not just a physical phenomena. There is a mental component. And that mental component is composed of various kinds of resistance to the pain, manifest as anxiety, fear, aversion, anger, depression, stress. And all of these mental reactions to the pain arise so naturally and so swiftly that unless you meditate, you just think it's just one thing. This is my pain. So in meditation, you're developing this, the subtlety of mind and the power of mind, where you can just pick these things apart, and you can separate the two, and then you can see, where there may be physical pain which is unbearable, and that's completely separate from mental reaction. It's not that meditating you never feel pain or you never feel something's unbearable, but you can reduce the suffering considerably, or even to zero. So you can have considerable pain, but zero suffering. That's the goal. If you're in that position of having to deal with pain. So, you know, often, you know, when you have pain, the thing is this panic. You know, you use this panic. I can't take this. I can't. It's terrible. What's going to happen? You say, yeah. And it's that panic that's unbearable, isn't it? It's not. Is it really the pain? No, I don't think so. Not always. Why we must to sit for eat or drink? If we don't do it, how to foretell other? How to tell others? Oh, this is like a convention. You know, we have less conventions about how we live together, rules that we agree upon, and this is one of the features. Thai culture and Thai manners has always been that it's adapted from the rules of the monk, the rules of conduct for monks. So many things that we say in Thailand, we say, well, it's polite, that's impolite. Where does that come from? It's not like a law of nature that something's polite and something's not polite. But it's an agreement in a community or in a culture or in a society. And in Thailand, these agreements have been derived mostly from the Vinaya, the monk's Vinaya. So this is one of the rules for monks, that you must always sit to eat or drink. And then when practice with monks or in this kind of more formal atmosphere, then we follow that. But it's not, say, like it's not bap or something really awful if you stand and eat something. Yeah, for me, because I've been brought up with this since I was, you know, a young man at 20 now, I see people walking and eating. It's just, it's like really gross, you know. That's just my perception, you know. I just see someone walking along the road going like this, you know. I still remember I was in New Zealand and I was sitting in a car with a senior monk, and this guy came along the road and he had two ice creams. And he's going, walking along the road. I thought, it's the grossest thing I ever seen in public, you know. So yeah, this is how perceptions come from, you know, practicing according to conventions. And so, how can I? Oh, it's 12 o'clock. How can I avoid my bad friend once make me do the wrong things? Say no, I won't do those wrong things. Let's say, just don't do them. Nobody can make you do things. They can try and make you feel guilty. Or say, you say you love me, and if you really love me, you do this. If you don't do it, it means you don't really love me. So, you know, this kind of like blackmail that people use. So if somebody talks to you like that, they're not a very good friend. You want to keep away from people like that. It's to try to use your emotions to blackmail you, or your sense of responsibility, or your fears of being abandoned. And with things like alcohol, for instance, you know, I know so many people have, or almost everybody struggles with this, but if you say that you don't drink, but you don't sort of say like you're better than they are because they drink, or and you're still friends, and maybe you can even go along and drink a non-alcoholic drink or something. You get teased, and people put a bit of pressure on you, make fun of you for a while, and then they just give up, and then that's just who you are. You don't drink. It's as easy as that. If you're just willing to be very tactful and polite, keep your sense of humor, don't get offended when people say things, don't be so easily pressured or manipulated. That's how you know. That's how you maintain your principles. You have to have your sense of what's right and what's wrong. And with the five precepts, that's a kind of cast iron standard for you. You can be sure if anything requires breaking the precepts, you're on dangerous ground. And if you can keep within the five precepts, even if you do stupid things every now and again, you'll be okay. Those are the kind of the bottom lines, the five precepts. And an employer's side to set the rule and regulations. For example, no mobile phone during workday unless lunch break is allowed. But one of employees said it's unfair for them. as an employer's side, can you please suggest, should rules still be the same in order to control organization, or should the rule be changed or cancelled? Well, you know, talking about CELA and regulations and so on, when speaking with school children, you know, I often say, look, this is not like the school's regulations, you know, and you're being forced to follow the school's regulations. These are your regulations. You know, these are agreements to create the best possible atmosphere in and conditions in the school. And it's not something that's being forced upon you, but it's part of, it should be your commitment to these. So you have to, I think, give people the sense of participation and give them the sense that their voice is heard. This is the worst thing. If you're a junior person and you think nobody up top, they're not interested in YF, they just do whatever they want to do. You know? But if you create a forum in which you open it up, well, you know, what do people think about this? You know, you say, this is why in the company, this is our logic. This is our thinking. You know, telephones, mobile phones are incredibly addictive for everyone. You know, we feel the same way, and they can just put your telephone on just for a moment, and you're just going to quickly send, and then someone sends you something, and then 10 minutes, 15 minutes have gone by. And it's so easy, not that you intend to do it, but these things are so addictive. So in the work period of from the time you come to work to a lunch hour, which is the time which you're being paid to work, then the company feels that then there should be no mobile phone usage, because this is the time devoted to work, unless you have some specific need for it. Now, somebody says, well, what about if there's an emergency at home? My father's very ill, and if something happened, you know, I would want to know. So, well, then it's like we do on a retreat. Can there be an emergency number that everybody can give to their family, so that if there's something important comes up, they can be they can feel that they'll be notified in a very short time. Then ask anybody, yeah, who's against this, on what grounds? And then you listen, people, and you allow people to feel that they've been heard. This is the important thing. Not that you necessarily change. You may adapt the regulation after you hear what people have to say, but it's more that you listen with respect to people's feelings and worries and concerns and desires. And then at the end of the day, you say, okay, thank you, and I'll take this away, and I'll get back to you on this. And then you may say, well, I've been through this at some length, and I feel that I still want to maintain this standard. These are my reasons. So that's up to you as an employer. You do have certain rights as an employer, as someone who is paying their wages. But in order to maintain morale and a good feeling in the company, and morale and gamlang jai, you know, is not so easily measurable, but in terms of output and productivity in a company, you know, it's one of the major factors. So having everyone on board and not just feeling that they're being pressured and forced to do things which are not fair or not right, and sometimes these objections are irrational, but you listen and just calmly explain your position. Okay, that's the English session.